second speaker for this session is Joshua Huxchild. He is an assistant professor of philosophy at Mount St. Mary's University in Emmitsburg, Maryland. He has his BA from Yale University, a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. His area for his PhD was medieval philosophy. But he has written on Catholic social thought and the agrarian tradition. Joshua has published essays and reviews in Modern Age, Intercollegiate Review, First Things, and the University Bookman. He previously taught at Wheaton College in Illinois. Joshua?
Thank you, Morton, and thank you to Bill Campbell for inviting me to be a part of this panel. It's an honor, although I'm not sure that it's a justice to match a professional libertarian with an amateur traditionalist like myself. I'm a traditionalist, and I think that's why I was asked to speak and maybe have some sparks fly, although I can guarantee sparks aren't going to fly between us over the value or the natural right of property. But I will, I hope, come at that from a different perspective. But I come at it as an amateur. As Morton mentioned, I'm a professor of philosophy. I teach things like Neoplatonism and Aristotle's metaphysics and medieval logic. And when I talk about politics, I'm definitely poaching. But it made me feel like I was not alone when I realized that I wanted to start my remarks by quoting another poacher. This one is a former English professor, Richard Weaver. Richard Weaver was a great defender of ownership. But we cannot ignore a strong qualification that Weaver gave to his defense of private property when he said that his defense offers nothing in defense of that kind of property brought into being by finance capitalism. You can hear the sneer. He continues, such property is, on the contrary, a violation of the very notion of proprietas. This amendment to the institution to suit the uses of commerce and technology has done more to threaten property than anything else yet conceived. He was an English professor. He chose his words well. He continues, respecters of private property are really obligated to oppose much that is done today in the name of private enterprise. Who owns that piano?
Sounds like a piano tuner.
So say it, Richard Weaver. How, and more importantly, why, did Weaver think we could distance our love of private property from finance capitalism? I think these questions are especially interesting and urgent for us in a time and place in which widespread home ownership means, in fact, widespread use of long-term bank mortgages to participate in the housing market, and in which the flagship proposal of an ownership society campaign was a universal program of private investment accounts. This is not what Weaver would have meant by an ownership society. Well, let us remember the heavy burden that Weaver was laying on the right of private property. It is, as we remember from the chapter title in Ideas Have Consequences, the last metaphysical right. Private property was invoked by Weaver not as a player in mid-20th century political and economic drama between capitalism and socialism. It was instead a player in the grand moral and metaphysical drama of the decline of the West. There needs to be, says Weaver, at this late stage, some absolute moral right for driving afresh the wedge between the material and the transcendental. Weaver thus strikes on private property as the last stand for moral and metaphysical realism, the one ancient right, perhaps strengthened rather than weakened by modern revolutions which overthrew other ancient rights. Private property is valuable for Weaver because an assertion of ownership is beyond contention, not subject to reduction by relativism or rationalism, nor by utilitarianism. Weaver is most decidedly not interested in defending private property as useful. To be sure, he is aware of the obvious practical benefits of a psychology of ownership, but property rights for Weaver would be valuable even if they did not have those practical benefits. Its status as a right, he says, does not depend on any test of social usefulness. The right of private property is valuable to Weaver because it puts man in touch with his true moral nature. It connects, as he puts it, man and his substance. The primary meaning of property for Weaver is not expressed in the power to dispose of something at will. After all, the focus on individual will is one of the things Weaver diagnoses as part of the crisis of modernity. Rather, property is something that is identified with the owner, something that has become assimilated to him, his own, proprietas. It is in light of this that we can understand Weaver's criticism of finance capitalism. I quote again, "The abstract property of stocks and bonds, the legal ownership of enterprises never seen, or we might add, enterprises never even understood, actually destroy the connection between man and his substance, without which metaphysical right becomes meaningless. Property, in this sense," Weaver continues, "becomes a fiction useful for exploitation, and it makes impossible the sanctification of work. Through concentration of wealth, rationalization of industry, and separation of man from the significance of what he owned, abstract property, the property of capital markets and large corporations, was not just a diminished form of property for Weaver, but a real threat to property. The moral solution, Weaver wrote, is the distributive ownership of small properties. These take the form of independent farms, of local businesses, of homes owned by occupants, where individual responsibility gives significance to prerogative over property." Now, I want to consider Weaver's moral preference for real over abstract property. There are many things that are quirky about the arguments of ideas have consequences, and I will be the first to admit this. Remember, the cultural crisis to which property is offered as a remedy was all supposed to start, according to the opening pages of Weaver's book, with the logical innovations of a 14th century scholastic. Now, I'm a scholar of medieval philosophy, as I've mentioned, and I happen to think that scholastic logic is very important, but believe me, this is a quirky way to start a book, and a surprise bestseller at that. But among Weaver's quirks, I do not think we can count his moral distinction between real and abstract property. Indeed, I think we can very quickly see how respectable a pedigree this distinction has in conservative thought. The most obvious and immediate connection is the American agrarian tradition. Weaver obviously identified himself with this tradition, and this is a tradition that often spoke of the value of real property, land, homes, and of course, after the name agrarianism, farms, and criticized the kinds of new abstract property that were the result of a particular kind of industrial and technological innovation. We can trace this back to Jeffersonian agrarianism, the favor of the yeoman farmer and the virtues that he exemplified. And I think even this agrarian spirit in American thought was appreciated by Tocqueville. The privilege of real property, especially productive land and shops, is also evident in the Catholic intellectual tradition, as in the rural life movement and the school of English Catholic distributists, Chesterton Belloc, and later Vincent McNabb and other Dominicans. These thinkers, in turn, naturally trace their views to Thomas Aquinas, whom we've already heard. Aquinas was a staunch defender of the natural right to property, but he argued further that we should distinguish kinds of property and kinds of wealth getting. He argued that a community which supplies its needs by trade is less self-sufficient and more subject to vicious acquisitiveness than one which can provide for itself from its own fertility and abundance. Now, this may to our ears sound like a romantic preference for the quiet medieval village over the bustling port city. But Aquinas had a reasoned position about the relative. That there should ever be an exclusion of commerce from the city. He did not think such an exclusion was possible. But he recommends that commerce in a city be moderate, that is, subject to a moral standard derived from the natural health of a self-sufficient community which supplies the bulk of its wealth from real or natural property. We can, in turn, trace Aquinas' views on wealth back to Plato and Aristotle. Lacking our varieties of abstract wealth, they were content to distinguish money, which is valuable in exchange, from other property, which has a value in its use. Accordingly, they distinguished different activities of wealth getting, and they both denigrated merchants, middlemen, and those who deal in money as parasitic on the real producers of wealth, craftsmen and husbandmen who were more worthy of citizenship. Thus, as Aristotle put it, the natural means of wealth getting is a legitimate part of managing a household, and so it finds its place in a healthy political order. While the artificial means of wealth getting, dependent upon trade and money, is not so ordered, it has not the noble, properly political aim of human happiness, but the vulgar and more selfish aim of merely acquiring wealth from property, the former valuable in exchange, of merely acquiring wealth. So, Plato and Aristotle, Aquinas, Jefferson and Tocqueville, British Catholic and American agrarian critics of modernity, not a bad pedigree, I would argue, for a conservative idea. But instead of tracing the development and genealogy of this idea, I would at this point like to summarize three important features of the moral preference for real property, three features which have this far remained only implicit. The first is this, that real property is more naturally susceptible to being widely distributed. One of the reasons for preferring real over artificial property, despite the aristocratic elitism implicit in the classical denigration of merchants and middlemen, is that real property is more democratic. It spreads the privileges and responsibilities of citizenship and ownership more widely than trade or finance capitalism, which both can tend towards concentration of wealth. Now, of course, it must be admitted that in our country, mortgages, for instance, and investment accounts could be widely distributed. But this distribution would be thanks to the economic interests of banks and of the government. The wide distribution of real property in the conservative tradition is attributed to natural limits to the amount of real wealth that is likely to be useful to an individual or to a household. Indeed, for Plato and Aristotle, a sign of the inferiority of artificial wealth getting was that the acquisitive appetite had no natural limit. In principle, insatiable, the pursuit of money was therefore absurd and inhumane. By contrast, the exigencies of embodied human life impose on real property or natural wealth production particular natural limits. In modern economic terminology, we would say that the rapidly declining marginal utility of more food than one can rent, more houses than one can live in, or more land than one can farm, foster the wide distribution of real property. Now, the notion of a natural limit for real property, which secured a democratic citizenship and reduced the likelihood of concentration and consolidation of wealth, obviously implies some notion of what is natural for human beings to have, to use, and to value. And this leads to my second feature of the moral preference for real property, and that is that it depends on a decidedly non-liberal conception of human nature. To view real property as superior is to have a certain kind of answer or certain kinds of answers to such questions as, what is man? What would fulfill or satisfy him? What should his relationships to other people and to his environment look like? Standard economic theory presupposes the liberal view of man, at least methodologically, if not metaphysically, which is much thinner than this. The autonomous will, the unencumbered, utility-maximizing self. By contrast, the preference for real property is based on a more traditional and more realistic anthropology. The value of land, homes, and shops is a reflection of our status as embodied souls, whose autonomy is always relative and dependent on the contexts of particular communities, with concrete physical, psychological, and even spiritual needs. To illustrate the different conceptions of human nature presumed by an affirmation or a denial of real property's superiority, consider a thought experiment. Imagine a world in which we all own sufficient abstract wealth to sustain ourselves. We would have enough money to purchase what we need to consume. In addition to receiving personal wages in compensation for our labor, we might own our own portfolios of stocks, which we could dispose of as we will, and by means of which we could generate even more wealth. We might even own our own generous individual private retirement accounts and our own individual private comprehensive health insurance policies, and our children might have their own education savings plans. In short, imagine that in terms of purely artificial wealth, we were a full-fledged ownership society. But now note that it is in principle consistent with this imagined scenario that our wages and investment accounts and insurance policies are all provided by the government, or, alternatively, that they are provided by one single global monopoly corporation which employs us all. Note further that it is consistent with this scenario to imagine that we have no choice but to consume only that food, that clothing, that housing, that entertainment, that medicine, and that education that this government or this monopolistic corporation provides for us to buy. Or we could imagine the post-human future, which has been forecast by various technological prophets, the future, not so far away, supposedly, in which computers and nanotechnology and whatever else they talk about have freed us from the burdens of bodies, emotions, death, love. The point is, nothing about a society of complete ownership of only financial wealth would guarantee our freedom from a socialist or a capitalist or a technological dystopia. Despite or even because of this sort of widespread ownership, our lives could become something that is not necessarily human at all. The second point about real property's implicit alternative conception of human nature thus naturally leads to the third feature that I want to highlight, namely, that the possession and use of real property is an irreplaceable occasion for the exercise of human virtue. Think for a moment about what is socially required in the ownership of real property, and especially of land and homes, as distinct from monetary accounts and securities portfolios. This kind of property immediately puts one into contact with other people in relationships of dependence and interdependence. First of all, one is more aware of one's relationships with one's family, one's parents, and one's children, the children who may stand to inherit the land, the property, the home that one lives in. Second of all, it puts one in relationship with one's neighbors who share a property line, who live in the same kind of environment, who find themselves in the same community. It is part of being a political animal that we spend our lives not as autonomous individuals, but living in these complex relations of dependence and interdependence. And it is these relations in which we learn the human virtues. Weaver calls the ownership of real property the indispensable opportunity for training in virtue. He mentions, first of all, the virtue of providence or foresight, the habit of caring for ourselves and those around us because we rely on the habit of caring for ourselves and those around us because we do not rely on the state underwriting our future. Weaver also writes about a sense of honor in one's own things and the products of one's work, a sense of honor which in turn contributes to good work and good stewardship of one's property. We could also speak, as Alistair MacIntyre has spoken, of the virtues of acknowledged dependence, those virtues that take account of the fact that we live in relationships of interdependence with other people. Peter Lawler recently argued that the ownership society should properly be called the caregiving society, a society in which people don't feel like autonomous individuals who are free from any relationship to other people, but in which we recognize and take ownership of our responsibilities for care of those around us. And conservatives should not forget that the deep problem with the social security system is not that we don't own our own allocation of money from the government, but that any universal government retirement security program removes some sense of personal and familial responsibility, some motive for sacrifice and for generosity, for the sake of our elders, for the sake of our youngers, some motive for developing a habit of foresight when we are young. These three isolated aspects of the moral preference for real property, the wide democratic distribution, a rich conception of human nature, and the fostering of virtue, are all contained, as I understand it, in the doctrine articulated in Catholic social teaching as the principle of subsidiarity. Quote up to the podium with me. According to that principle, there are certain tasks and functions which naturally belong to individuals and to associations of individuals, families and neighborhoods, and which, even if they could be performed more efficiently by higher, more centralized, more bureaucratic associations, should not be performed by those associations, should not be taken away from, and should not be ceded by the lower, more natural levels of association. Pius XI, in the encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, put it this way: "It is an injustice, and at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order, to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organizations can do." That was 1931. A year earlier in 1930, Andrew Nelson Lytle gave the agrarian spin on this, and it's a lot snappier. "Throw out the radio and take down the fiddle from the wall." To head off the most predictable objection to the moral preference of real property, I would end by emphasizing that nothing I have said, nothing about the moral superiority of real property, nothing about my three highlighted themes, is incompatible with a full commitment to free markets. Nor, historically, have the Catholic or agrarian conservative traditions been incompatible with such a commitment. The Southern agrarians actually thought they were better libertarians than the Northern industrialists, whose economy depended on an elaborate legal apparatus and government subsidies. And the social teaching of the Catholic Church has been just as clear in its defense of the natural right to private property and its condemnation of socialism as any libertarian could ever wish. Both traditions, however, insist that the economic realities of free markets not be separated from the practical realities of governing political communities and, more importantly, that economics and politics, in turn, are properly understood as departments of ethics, which is to say that both are valuable only insofar as they serve the human good, the good of individual men and the good of human community. The conservative position should therefore be that it is only through widespread ownership of real property that many individual owners can share in a true ownership society. Thank you.